Subdued by the sadness of after-love and by the certain knowledge that her world was forever altered, Tara was silent on the drive back to Molly's home. She parked a block before she reached it, and keeping the engine running, she turned to examine his face in the reflection of the street lights. "When will I see you again?" she asked the question that countless women in her position had asked before her. "Do you wish to see me again? More than anything else in my life?" She did not at that moment even think of her children. He was the only thing in her existence. "It will be dangerous."
"I know. The penalties if we are discovered, disgrace, ostracism, imprisonment, your life would be destroyed."
"My life was a sham," she said softly. "Its destruction would be no great loss."
He studied her features carefully, searching for insincerity. At last he was satisfied. "I will send for you when it is safe."
"I will come immediately whenever you call."
"I must leave you now. Take me back." She parked at the side of Molly's house, in the shadow where they could not be observed from the road. "Now the subterfuge and dissembling begins," she thought calmly. "I was right. It will never be the same again." He made no attempt to embrace her. It was not the African way. He stared at her, the whites of his eyes gleaming like ivory in the half-dark. "You realize that when you choose me, you choose the struggle?" he asked.
"Yes, I know that."
"You have become a warrior, and you and your wants, even your life, are of no consequence. If you have to die for this struggle, I will not lift my hand to save you."
She nodded. "Yes, I know that."
The nobility of the concept filled her chest and made it difficult for her to breathe, so her voice was labored as she whispered,
"Greater love hath no man. I will make any sacrifice you ask of me."
Moses went to the guest bedroom which Molly had allocated to him, and as he washed his face in the basin, Marcus Archer slipped into the room without knocking, closed the door and leaned against it, watching Moses in the mirror. "Well?" he asked at last, as though he was reluctant to hear the answer. "Just as we planned it," Moses dried his face on a clean towel. "I hate the silly little bitch," Marcus said softly. "We agreed it was necessary." Moses selected a fresh shirt from the valise on his bed. "I know we agreed," Marcus said. "It was my suggestion, if you remember, but I do not have to like her for it. She is an instrument. It is folly to let your personal feelings intrude." Marcus Archer nodded. In the end, he hoped he could act like a true revolutionary, one of the steely, hard men which the struggle needed, but his feelings for this man, Moses Garmer, were stronger than all his political convictions. He knew that it was completely one-sided. Over the years, Moses Garmer had used him as cynically and as calculating as he now planned to use the Courtney woman. His vast sexual appeal was to Moses Garmer merely another weapon in his arsenal, another means of manipulating people. He could use it on men or women, young or old, no matter how attractive or unappealing. And Marcus admired him for the ability, and at the same time was devastated by it. "We leave for the Witwatersrand tomorrow," he said, as he pushed himself away from the door for a moment, controlling his jealousy. "I've made all the arrangements."
"So soon?" Moses asked.
"I've made the arrangements. We'll travel by car." It was one of the problems which dogged their work. It was difficult for a black man to travel about the huge subcontinent, liable as he was at any time to demands to show his dompas and to interrogation when the authority realized that he was far from the domicile shown on the pass without apparent reason, or that the pass had not been stamped by an employer. Moses' association with Marcus and the nominal employment he provided with the Chamber of Mines gave him valuable cover when it was necessary to travel. But they always needed couriers. That was one of the functions that Tara Courtney would perform. In addition, she was by birth and by marriage highly placed, and the information she could provide would be of the greatest value in the planning. Later, after she had proved herself, There would be other, more dangerous work. In the end, Shasa Courtney realized it was his mother's advice which would tip the fine balance and decide whether he accepted or rejected the offer that had been made to him during the Springbok hunt on the open plains of the Orange Free State. Shasa would have been the first to despise any other man of his age who was still firmly enmeshed in the maternal apron strings. But he never considered that this applied to him. The fact that Santin Courtney Malcolm S. was his mother was merely incidental. What influenced him was that she was the shrewdest financial and political brain he had access to. She was also his business partner and his only true confidant. To make such an important decision without consulting her never even occurred to him. He waited a week after his return to Cape Town to let his own feelings distill out, and for an opportunity to have Santin alone, for he was in no doubt as to what his stepfather's reaction would be to the proposal. Blaine Malcolm S. was the opposition representative on the parliamentary subcommittee examining the proposed establishment of an oil-from-coal project, part of the government's long-term plan to reduce the country's reliance on imported crude oil. The committee was going to take evidence on site, and for once Santin was not accompanying her husband. That was the opportunity Shasa needed. It was less than half an hour's drive from Weltevreden, across the Constantia Neck Pass, and down the other side of the mountains to the Atlantic seaboard, where the home that Santin had made for Blaine stood on 500 acres of wild, protea-covered mountainside that dropped steeply down to rocky headlands and white beaches. The original house, Rhodes Hill, had been built during Queen Victoria's reign by one of the old mining magnates from the Rand, but Santin had stripped the interior and refurbished it completely. She was waiting for Shasa on the veranda when he parked the Jaguar and ran up the steps to embrace her. "You're getting too thin," she scolded him fondly. She had guessed from his telephone call that he wanted a serious discussion, and they had their own traditions. Santin was dressed in an open-neck cotton blouse and slacks with comfortable hiking boots, and without discussing it, she took his arm and they set out along the path that skirted her rose gardens and climbed the untended hillside. The last part of the ascent was steep and the path rough, but Santin took it without pause and came out on the summit head ahead of him. Her breathing was hardly altered and within a minute had returned to normal. "She keeps herself in wonderful condition. Heaven alone knows what she spends on health cures and potions. And she exercises like a professional athlete," Shasa thought, as he grinned down at her proudly. He placed an arm around her small, firm waist. "Isn't it beautiful?" Santin leaned lightly against him and looked out over the cold green Benguela current as it swirled, decked in lacy foam, around Africa's heel, which, like a medieval knight, was spurred and armoured with black rock. "This is one of my favourite places." "Whoever would have guessed it," Shasa murmured, and led her to the flat, lichen-covered rock that was her seat. She perched up on it, hugging her knees, and he sprawled on the bed of moss below her. They were both silent for a few moments, and Shasa wondered how often they had sat like this at this special place of hers, and how many heavy decisions they had taken here. "Do you remember Manfred de la Rey?" he asked suddenly. But he was unprepared for her reaction. She started and looked down at him, colour draining from her cheeks, with an expression he could not fathom. "Is something wrong, mater?" He began to rise, but she gestured at him to remain seated. "Why do you ask about him?" she demanded. But he did not reply directly. "Isn't it strange how our paths seem to cross with his family? Ever since his father rescued us, when I was an infant, and we were castaways living with the bushmen in the Kalahari." "We needn't go over all that again," Santin stopped him, and her tone was brusque. Shasa realized he had been tactless. Manfred's father had robbed the Hanni mine of almost £1 million worth of diamonds, an act of vengeance for fancied wrongs that he had convinced himself Santin had inflicted on him. For that crime he had served almost 15 years of a life sentence for robbery, and had been pardoned only when the Nationalist government had come to power in 1948. At the same time, The Nationalists had pardoned many other Afrikaners, serving sentences for treason and sabotage and armed robbery, convicted by the Smuts government when they had attempted to disrupt the country's war effort against Nazi Germany. However, the stolen diamonds had never been recovered, and their loss had almost destroyed the fortune that Santan Courtney had built up with so much labour, sacrifice, and heartache.
"Why do you mention Manfred de la Rey?" she repeated her question.
"I had an invitation from him to a meeting, a clandestine meeting, all very cloak and dagger."
"Did you go?"
He nodded slowly. "We met at a farm in the Free State, and there were two other cabinet ministers present."
"Did you speak to Manfred alone?" she asked.
And the tone of the question, the fact that she had used his Christian name, caught Shaz's attention. Then he remembered the unexpected question that Manfred de la Rey had put to him.
"Has your mother ever spoken about me?" he had asked.
And faced by Santin's present reaction to his name, the question took on a new significance.
"Yes, Mater, I spoke to him alone." "Did he mention me?" Santin demanded.
And Shaza gave a little chuckle of puzzlement. "He asked the same question, whether you ever spoke about him. Why are the two of you so interested in each other?"
Santin's expression turned bleak, and he saw her close her mind to him.
It was a mystery he would not solve by pursuing openly. He would have to stalk it.
"They made me a proposition," and he saw her interest reawaken.
"Manfred, a proposition? Tell me." "They want me to cross the floor."
She nodded slowly, showing little surprise, and not immediately rejecting the idea.
He knew that if Blaine were here, it would have been different. Blaine's sense of honour, his rigid principles, would have left no room for manoeuvre. Blaine was a Smuts man, heart and blood, and even though the old Field Marshal had died of a broken heart soon after the Nationalists unseated him and took over the reins of power, still Blaine was forever true to the old man's memory.
"I can guess why they want you," Santin said slowly. "They need the top financial brain, an organizer and a businessman. It's the one thing they lack in their cabinet."
He nodded. She had seen it instantly, and his enormous respect for her was confirmed yet again.
"What price are they willing to pay?" she demanded.
"A cabinet appointment? Minister of Mines and Industry?" He saw her eyes go out of focus and cross in a myopic stare as she gazed out to sea. He knew what that expression meant. Santin was calculating, juggling with the future, and he waited patiently until her eyes snapped back into focus.
"Can you see any reason for refusing?" she asked.
"How about my political principles?"
"How do they differ from you, from theirs?"
"I am not an Afrikaner."
"That might be to your advantage. You will be their token Englishman. They will give you special status. You will have a freer rein. They will be more reluctant to fire you than if you were one of their own."
"I don't agree with their native policy, this apartheid thing of theirs. It's just financially unsound."
"Good Lord, Shaza, you don't believe in equal political rights for the blacks, do you? Not even Yanni Smuts wanted that. You don't want another Shaka ruling us? Black judges and a black police force working for a black dictator?"
She shuddered.
"We'd get pretty short shrift from them."
"No, Mater, of course not. But this apartheid thing is merely a device for grabbing the whole pie. We have to give them a slice of it. We can't hog it all. That's a certain recipe for eventual bloody revolution."
"Very well, chérie. If you are in the cabinet, you can see to it that they get a fair crack of the whip."
He looked dubious and made a sideshow of selecting a cigarette from his gold case and lighting it.
"You have a special talent, Shaza," Santin went on persuasively. "It's your duty to use it for the good of all."
Still, he hesitated. He wanted her to declare herself fully. He had to know if she wanted this as much as he did.
"We can be honest with each other, chérie. That is what we have worked towards since you were a child. Take this job and do it well. After that, who knows what else may follow?"
They were both silent then. They knew what they hoped would follow. They could not help themselves. It was their nature always to strive towards the highest pinnacle. "And what about Blaine?" Shaza said at last. "How will he take it? I don't look forward to telling him."
"I'll do that," she promised. "But you will have to tell Tara."
"Tara," he sighed. "Now that will be a problem." They were silent again, until Santan asked,
"How would you do it? If you cross the floor, it will expose you to a blaze of hostile publicity."
So it was agreed without further words. Only the means remained to be discussed.
"At the next general election, I will simply campaign in different colors," Shasa said. "They will give me a safe seat."
"So we have little time to arrange the details, then." They discussed them for another hour, planning with all the meticulous attention that had made them such a formidably successful team over the years, until Shaza looked up at her.
"Thank you," he said simply. "What would I ever do without you? You're tougher and cleverer than any man I know."
"Oh, get away with you," she smiled. "You know how I hate praise."
They both laughed at that absurdity. "I'll walk you down, Mater." But she shook her head.
"I've still got some thinking to do. Leave me here."
She watched him go down the hill, and her love and pride was so intense as to almost suffocate her.
"He is everything I ever wanted in a son, and he has fulfilled all my expectations 1,000 times over. Thank you, my son, thank you for the joy you have always given me."
Then abruptly the words, "my son," triggered another reaction, and her mind darted back to the earlier part of their conversation. "Do you remember Manfred de la Rey?" Shaza had asked her. But he could never know what the answer to that must be. "Can a woman ever forget the child she bears?" She whispered the reply aloud. But her words were lost on the wind, and on the sound of the green surf breaking on the rocky shore below the hill.